There had been three sons. One had died before he had lived, stillborn in the great wilderness beyond the Limpopo River. Another had been born by a woman who was not his wife, and the son had called another man father. Here Sean felt the melancholy deepen, laden with guilt. But this son was dead also, burned to a charred black mass in the flimsy machine of wood and canvas in which he had flown the sky. The words of Gary's dedication to his new book was clear in Sean's mind. "This book is dedicated to Captain Michael Courtney, DFC, one of the young eagles who will fly no more." Michael had been Sean's natural son, made in the belly of his brother's wife. The third son lived still, but he was a son in name only, and Sean would have changed that name had it been within his power. Those ugly incidents that preceded Dirk Courtney's departure from Ladyburg so many years before, among them casual arson and careless murder, were nothing compared to the evil deeds he had perpetrated since his return. Those close to him knew better than to speak the name Dirk Courtney in his hearing. Now he felt the melancholy change to the old anger, and to forestall it, he leaned forward in his seat and tapped the chauffeur's shoulder. "Pull up beside him," he said, pointing to Mark Anders. "What you need is fresh air," Sean Courtney told Mark. "It will sober you up and make you puke, either of which is desirable." And by the time the Rolls parked at the foot of West Street Pier, Mark had, by dint of enormous mental effort, regained control of his eyes. At first, every time he peered at the general beside him, he had the nauseous certainty that there was a third eye growing in the centre of his forehead, and that he had multiple ears on each side of his head, like ripples on the surface of a pond. Mark's voice had at first been as uncontrolled, and he had listened with mild disbelief to the odd, blurred sounds with which his lips had replied to the general's questions and comments. But when he frowned with the effort and spoke with the exaggerated slowness and articulation, it sounded vaguely intelligible. However, it was only when they walked side by side down through the loose sand to the edge of the sea, where the outgoing tide had left the sand hard and wet and smooth, that he began to listen to what the general was saying. And it wasn't tea party talk. He was talking of power and powerful men. He was talking of endeavour and reward. And though his voice was rumbling and relaxed, yet it was like the purr of an old lion who was just killed and would kill again. Somehow, Mark sensed that what he was hearing was of great value, and he hated himself for the alcohol in his veins that slowed his mind and halted his tongue. He fought it off actively. They walked down along the glistening strip of wet, smooth sand that was polished yellow by the sinking glow of the late moon. The sea smelt of salt and iodine, a crisp, antiseptic smell, and the little breeze chilled him so that he shivered, even in his dinner jacket. But soon his brain was keeping pace with that of the burly figure that limped beside him, and slowly a sense of excitement built up within him as he heard things said that he had only sensed deep in some secret place of his soul, ideas that he recognised, but that he believed were his alone. His tongue lost its drag and blur, and he felt suddenly bright as a blade, and light as the swallow that drinks in flight as it skims the water. He remembered how he had at one time suspected that this man might have been responsible in some way for the loss of Andersland and the old man's death. By now those suspicions smacked almost of blasphemy, and he thrust them aside to throw all his mind into the discussion in which he found himself so deeply involved. He never did suspect until long afterwards how important that single night's talk would be in his life, and if he had known, perhaps his tongue would have seized up solid in his mouth and his brain refused to keep pace, for he was undergoing a rigorous examination. Ideas thrown at Mark, seemingly at random, were for him to pick up and carry forward or to reject and leave lying. Every question raked his conscience and bared his principles, and gradually, skilfully, he was forced to commit himself on every subject from religion to politics, from patriotism to morals. Once or twice the general chuckled, "You're a radical, did you know that? But I suppose I was at your age. We all want to change the world. Now tell me, what do you think about?" And the next question was not related to the one that preceded it. "There are 10 million black men in this country and 1 million whites. How do you think they're going to be able to live together for the next 1,000 years? Mark gulped at the enormity of the question, and then began to talk. The moon paled away in the coming of the dawn, and Mark walked on into an enchanted world of flaming ideas and amazing visions. Though he could not know it, his excitement was shared. Louis Botha, the old warrior and statesman, had said to Sean once, "Even the best of us gets old and tired, Sean, and when that happens, a man should have somebody to whom he can pass the torch and let him carry it on." With a suddenness that took them both by surprise, the night was past, and the sky flamed with gold and pink. They stood side by side and watched the rim of the sun rise from the dark green sea and climb swiftly into the sky. "I've needed an assistant for many years now. My wife hounds me," Sean chuckled at the hyperbole. "And I've promised her I'll find one. But I need somebody quick and bright and trustworthy. They are hard to find." Sean's cigar was long dead and horribly chewed. He took it from his mouth and examined it with mild disapproval before tossing it into the creeping wavelets at his feet. "It'd be a hell of a job. No regular hours, no set duties. And God knows I'd hate to work for me, because I am a cantankerous, unsympathetic old bastard. But on the other hand, one thing I'd guarantee. Whoever took the job wouldn't die of boredom, and he'd get to learn a thing or two." He turned now, thrusting his head forward and staring into Mark's face. The wind had ruffled his beard, and he had long ago stripped off his black tie and thrust it into a pocket. The golden rays of the rising sun caught his eyes, and they were a peculiarly beautiful shade of blue. "Do you want the job?" he demanded. "Yes, sir," Mark answered instantly, dazzled by the prospect of an endless association with this incredible man. "You haven't asked about the money," growled Sean. "Oh, the money isn't important." "Lesson number one," Sean cocked a beetling black eyebrow over the amused blue twinkle of his eye. "The money is always important." The next time Mark entered the gates of Emoyeni was to enter a new life, an existence beyond any he had ever imagined. And yet, in all the overpowering new experience, even in the whirl of having to adjust to new ideas, to the daunting procession of visitors and endless new tasks, there was one moment that Mark dreaded constantly. This was his next meeting with Miss Storm Courtney. However, he would never know if it had not been carefully arranged by General Courtney. But Storm was not at Emoyeni on Mark's first day, nor during the days that followed, although the memory of her presence seemed everywhere in the portraits and photographs in every room, especially the full-length oil in the library where Mark spent much of his time. She was dressed in a full-length ivory-coloured dress, seated at the grand piano in the main drawing-room, and the artist had managed to capture a little of her beauty and spirit. Mark found the tantalising scrutiny which the portrait directed at him disconcerting. Quickly, a relationship was established between Mark and the General, and during the first few days, the last of Sean's misgivings were set at rest. It was seldom that the close proximity of another human being over an extended period of time did not begin to irritate Sean, and yet with this youngster he found himself seeking his company. His first ideas had been that Mark should be taught to deal with day-to-day correspondence and all the other time-consuming trivia, leaving Sean a little more leisure and time to devote to the important areas of business and politics. Now he would drift through into the library at odd times to discuss an idea with Mark, enjoying seeing it through younger and fresher eyes, or he might dismiss his chauffeur and have Mark drive the rolls out to one of the sawmills, or to a board meeting in the city, sitting up front beside him on the journey and reminiscing about those days in France, or going further back to the time before Mark was born, enjoying Mark's engrossing interest in talks of gold prospecting and ivory hunting in the great wilderness beyond the Limpopo River in the north. "There'll be an interesting debate in assembly today, Mark. I'm going to give that bastard Hendricks hell on the railway budget. Drive me down and you can listen from the visitors' gallery. Those letters can wait until tomorrow. There's been a breakdown at the Umvoti sawmill. We'll take the shotguns on the way back, try and pick up a couple of guinea fowl. Drill hall at 8 o'clock tonight, Mark, if you aren't doing anything important," which was a command, no matter how delicate the phrasing. And Mark found himself sucked gently back into the ranks of the peacetime regiment. He found it different from France, for he now had powerful patronage. "You are no use to me as a third-rank marker. You're getting to know the way I work, son, and I want you at hand even when we are playing at soldiers. Besides," and here Sean grinned that evil, knowing grin, "you need a little time for range practice." At the next turnout, still not accustomed to the speed with which things happened in the world ruled by Sean Courtney, Mark found himself in the full fig of second lieutenant, including Sam Brown cross-strap and shining single pips on his shoulders. He had expected antagonism, or at least condescension, from his brother officers, but found that when he was placed in command of range drill, he was received with universal enthusiasm. In the household, Mark's standing was not at first clear. He was awed by the mistress of Emoweni, by her mature beauty and cool efficiency. She was remote but courteous for the first 2 weeks or so, referring to him as Mr. Anders, and any request was preceded by a meticulous please, and followed by an equally punctilious thank you. When the General and Mark were at Emoweni for the midday meal, Mark was served by one of the servants from a silver tray in the library, and in the evenings, after he had taken his leave from the General, he climbed on the elderly Ariel Square 4 motorcycle he had acquired and clattered off down the hill into the sweltering basin of the city to his verminous lodgings in Point Road. Ruth Courtney was watching Mark with an even shrewder eye than her husband had used. Had he in any way fallen short of her standards, she would have had no compunction in immediately bringing all her influence to bear on Sean for his dismissal. One morning, while Mark was at work in the library, Ruth came in from the garden with an armful of cut flowers. "Don't let me disturb you," she began to arrange the flowers in the silver bowl on the central table. For the first few minutes she worked in silence, and then, in a natural and friendly manner, she began to chat to Mark, quietly drawing from him the details of his domestic arrangements, where he slept and ate and who did his laundry, and secretly she was appalled. "You must bring your laundry up here to be done with the household washing." "Well, it's very kind of you, Mrs. Courtney. I don't want to be a nuisance." "Oh, nonsense. There are two Derby Wallers, with nothing else to do but wash and iron." Even Ruth Courtney, one of the first ladies of Natal, still a renowned beauty as a matron well past 40 years of age, was not immune to Mark's unstudied appeal. To his natural charm was added the beneficial effect his coming had upon her own man. Sean seemed younger, more light-hearted in these last weeks, and watching it she realized that it was not only the burden of routine work that had been lifted from him. The boy was giving him back a little of that spirit of youth, that freshness of thought, that energy and enthusiasm for the things of life that had gone slightly stale and seemed no longer quite worth the effort. It was their custom to spend the hour before bed in Ruth's boudoir, Sean lounging in a quilted dressing gown, watching her brush out her hair and cream her face, smoking his last cigar, discussing the day's events, while he enjoyed her still slim, lithe body under the thin silk of her nightdress, feeling the slow awakening of his own body in anticipation of the moment when she would turn from watching him in the mirror and rise, holding out one hand to him, and lead him through into the bedroom, to the huge four-poster bed under the draped and tasseled velvet canopy. Three or four times in the weeks since Mark's arrival in the household, Sean had made a remark so radical, so unlike his usual old-fashioned conservative self, that Ruth had dropped the silver hairbrush into her lap and turned to stare at him. Each time he had laughed self-consciously and held up a hand to prevent her teasing. "All right, I know what you're going to say, but I was discussing it with young Mark." He would chuckle again. "That boy talks a lot of good sense." Then one evening, after Mark had been with them just over a month, they had sat in companionable silence for a while, when Sean said suddenly, "Young Mark, doesn't he remind you of Michael?" I hadn't noticed, no, and no, I don't think so." No, I don't. I don't mean his looks. It's just something about the way he thinks."